Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Welcome, Zahava Ginsberg, to the Autism Roundtable. You come with such amazing experience as a child life coach specialist. So tell us a little bit about your journey and your connection with the autism world.
So my name is Zahava Ginsberg. I'm so honored to be on this podcast. I have a lot of experience working with all types of children. I work currently in a hospital. And I have my own private practice, but I do have a lot of experience working with children with all different types of abilities, and it has helped me shape who I am and how I continue to work in the field.
So tell us a little bit about what inspired you to go into this field, because it's not often that we hear of people in this field. So tell us a little bit about what inspired you to go in that direction.
So I used to volunteer a lot when I was in college for a few different organizations where I would do respite care for children in hospitals and take shifts so that their parents can go back to their other children or just have a few minutes to themselves. And I really was there as the advocate and advocating for the patient's behalf. And I would take some overnights and sleep, and then I would meet some child life specialists. And I got really inspired. I love the medical field. I love working with children, again, with all different types of abilities. And I just found this field called child life, and it really is something that I'm super passionate about, really appreciate what I do and love what I do every day.
Amazing, amazing. Okay, so I guess what we'll start with is discussing what you do in a hospital setting, and then you mentioned you had a private practice as well, so I'd like to hear what you do there as well. Tell us a little bit about your encounters with all kinds of children, particularly neurodiverse children, what your encounters are, and how a child life specialist could be of help to children that go through the hospital system.
Sure. So maybe I'll just explain quickly what a child life specialist is. I feel like we're just keep using that word and maybe people don't know what I am.
Good. Thank you.
Sure. So a child life specialist is somebody that has specific training in child development and the medical world, and really tries to bridge that gap and tries to help children and families process medical complexities and medical experiences in a more positive, friendly way. So specifically dealing with children with neurodiversities or autism, I really do focus a lot on sensory and sensory overstimulation and making them understand the environment. So for a typical child, it still is scary going to the hospital, going to a doctor. All of these experiences are the unknown, and a lot of things happening, people touching and getting on a scale or doing blood work or whatever it is. It's very scary and overwhelming for a typical child, but for even more so for a child that is on the spectrum or neurodiversity, because those sensory stimulations are even more heightened. So I really do focus on how to work the environment to have the child feel most comfortable and get that medical procedure done in the most safe and efficient way for them.
Okay, tell us a little bit about, like, you know, I understand, like, very medically needy children are going to come across your door, but we've discussed in previous conversations where why might you come in contact with children? What might they be coming into the hospital for?
Sure. So sometimes, I do cover a bunch of areas in the hospital, but children do come in for same day surgery. I do cover the pediatric floor in general in the PICU, the pediatric ICU. I cover the burn unit, which is a big unit that we'll discuss a little bit later. And then I cover some of the adult units for bereavement and some stuff like that, which we'll discuss later. But children can come in for same day surgery. If there's an endoscopy, colonoscopy, any sort of procedure like that, maybe some EEG. Sometimes they do same-day EEGs. And some of those procedures can be very scary, overwhelming. And just having somebody who's a child life specialist who can help bridge that gap. So working with the parents, asking them what works for their child, how can we make it the best situation for them? And then working with the hospital and the staff who needs to get the procedure done, and how can we collaborate to make this the best situation for that child or individual.
Wow. And when does that planning happen? Does that happen before the visit, during the visit, when a child melts down? Like, when is it that you come into the picture?
The best thing I would say is the more planning you can give the hospital or the doctor's office to call for a child life specialist or ask if they have one, the better it will be for you and for your child. Unfortunately, I do get a lot of calls while I hear the child screaming, and then I'm there to try and help settle everything down. But if you can, again, call in advance, it's the best. And I can speak to the parent ahead of time, teach them a little bit about what that procedure looks like, tell them maybe about some like items they might want to bring or how their day might look, as opposed to like a scheduler in a doctor's office that's just going to schedule you an appointment, to really go through that step. So you can definitely call ahead and ask for that. In same-day surgery, I am often called. It's early, early mornings. They try to prioritize children with autism or on the spectrum because they understand that those children and individuals can't necessarily wait that long. And I think the best thing I can say right now about asking for child life is really just advocating for your own child and telling the doctor's offices or the hospitals or whoever you're going to be in contact with about your child so that they can come prepared and try their best to accommodate those needs.
Wow. Yeah. And in a way, sometimes, you know, if we plan ahead and we have that plan, you know, transitions for children on the autism spectrum can be really difficult. So if we're able to pre-plan and tell them about what's going to happen for a second and third, and like you mentioned, maybe bringing along different like things that will soothe them, that will calm them, just to make that plan ahead of time is a great idea. And it's also good to know that you could call ahead on same day surgery, even if you're not planning to be there for a long time, that child life services are still available even for in and out.
Sure. Yeah, we definitely try. Again, we prioritize different places depending on the hospital, also on how many staff they have. But in general, I would say for child life specialists, they do try and prioritize those who need the most support and where it is.
Wow. Which hospital are you working in?
So I'm at Cooperman Barnabas in Livingston, New Jersey for right now. And then I do have my private practice on the side where I do see clients virtually in New York and in person in New Jersey. And yeah, try and help a little bit everywhere.
A little bit everywhere. Okay. Before we move on to like the private practice and reaching out virtually, because I think that's a great topic in itself. Let's talk a little bit about like you mentioned the burn unit. How often are you seeing burns in children altogether, and how often are you seeing a child with autism in a burn unit?
So that's a really like niche type of conversation to have, which I really do appreciate you having me here so that I can hopefully get to some parents and really get this message out there. But we do have children, I would say, pretty often, not as often as adults. It is an adult and pediatric unit. We do have the state burn unit. And we do get, I would say, a lot of children with autism or on the spectrum because, unfortunately, things happen really quick with burns in general. But I think a lot of times with children with autism or individuals with autism, they don't realize and they touch a stove after it's been on, or they're in the kitchen and the mom is moving a hot water to strain the noodles and the child is right there and bumps in, or just like quick small accidents that happen in 3 seconds, and then the child ends up becoming a patient in the hospital for a few weeks. So burns are quite extensive. The care for burns is quite painful. Hopefully if a child gets a burn, it's pretty small and they can be seen in the outpatient clinic that we have, which I do see patients there often. But unfortunately, we do get kids that are severely burned. And the process is really painful. It's bandaging and bathing every single day. And sensory wise, the cream is cold and the bandages are tight, and like it can be very overstimulating. So I really do try and prioritize when they have those hydrotherapies to help them with iPads or music or whatever it is to help them soothe. And then in terms of sibling support, a lot of times I'll provide sibling support because, again, burns happen quickly and the sibling may have seen it happen. And next thing they know, their sibling is in the hospital being bandaged up and they can't necessarily come see them. So I will work virtually or meet them in the lobby, make some dolls. But in terms of working with the child, really helping them understand what's happening, again, a sequence. I know we use that a lot in EBA. Like an order, a sequencing board, or a story, a social story I'll make a lot of times. Different types of things I do, but the burn unit is really a heavily populated area. And we do see a bunch of kids with autism or on the spectrum, and it can be even harder for them.
Yeah, and what you were explaining is like that lack of body awareness sometimes when children don't know where their body is in space, and it would never be intentional, but right, we might put our body in the wrong spot at the wrong time, and hot things is, that's a scary thing. So just being mindful of the lack of body awareness, and a lot of times I also see like safety awareness as an issue as well, like some children on the autism spectrum won't have that cognitive awareness of you know, reading the label that says it's too hot, or maybe even that learned history that, you know, if you touch it, it's going to be hot. They might go to it again. I also had one of my own children who didn't have the right amount of feeling when she would get hurt. So she would fall and like not even cry, or she would maybe touch something hot and not even feel it. And in my work with children on the autism spectrum, I've seen that as well, where their proprioceptive system is not aligned, and therefore they're not feeling the heat, or they're not feeling the pain like a neurotypical child would. And sometimes it's important as parents to also educate them on that, you know, oh, you don't feel it the same way. So if you feel it a little bit, right? And also there's other kind of sensory stuff that we could do to help prevent that kind of a thing. But okay, we're going to go back.
And one more thing I just want to jump in is I find it even with my own son that putting a child in the bathtub, sometimes they want more water. And I know a lot of times water can be very soothing for children with autism, and a bath is like a very exciting time as time they might be able to relax. But turning that faucet really quickly can make it really hot. So that's something I am always nervous about with my own son, that he's like, more water, and then he's like going to turn it too hot. But something just to pay attention to, that water can be very soothing, but just to make sure the temperature is safe enough.
Safe enough, yeah. Fire safety, heat safety, these are great, great points, and something to be just extra vigilant about, because we don't want to come see you on the burn unit.
I'm happy just to let for people to listen about me, but don't want to meet you.
I love that. I love that. I appreciate that. Okay, so tell us a little bit more. So I loved hearing about the burn unit. Tell us a little bit more about what you see in your day, and how else you come into contact with the neurodiverse population.
Sure. So a lot of times we have a special program called SNAP, Special Needs Ambassador Program, where we will meet children with autism and their caregiver early in the morning, me and my supervisor, and we will get their blood work done that their doctor has prescribed. So we have an outpatient lab in the hospital, like every hospital does, and we work really hard together to try and get all of their blood works done together. So sometimes doctors will order from one place and the other, and I think as a parent you can also do the same, is try and talk to all the doctors and say, like, what do we need to get done? Let's get it all done now. Like, let's do blood all at once because it's very hard for my child. Let's get, if you need this test done, like, let's do it all at once, and really trying to combine them. So that's something that my supervisor will try and overlook and see if there's a way to combine tests. And then we will try and get those blood work done early in the morning. And that normally looks like when the parent is registering, I will sit with the child and I'll start to play with them and get to know who they are, get to know what works for them, what doesn't, while the parent is signing in. And then we will do the blood work in a small room, and we have our old setup. We have some distraction items, and we work again with the parents to try and accomplish the blood work. And these are routine things that children and adults need. Blood work is something that is common and happens, but it can be extremely.
Once a year, I get that script for my kids from the doctors, and he hands it to me so casually, like, oh, go take them for blood work. And I'm thinking, oh, go to battle now, you know, like it's really not an easy.
It's not as easy. Even the flu shot is so hard to get your child to do. And these are tasks that, like, the doctor, again, will just hand it to the parent and be like, okay, go get this. And you're almost in this position where you have to battle with your child. So even more so for parents with neurodiverse children, it can be extremely hard. And that's where I think Child Life can help a lot. And we can do medical preparation, playing out scenarios, playing with actual test tubes and whatever else can be used in those medical situations to try and alleviate some stress. Coming up with some coping plans can also be very helpful. And then again, informing the staff of your child's disabilities or stuff like that. But in terms of my day, it's really doing some SNAP patients, seeing patients on the pediatric floor, bringing them toys or games that are appropriate for them. We do have a playroom, which is really helpful in the hospital. And assuming the child is not on any precautions, they can come, and we have a whole different types of stations. We have an art station, and we have an art therapist who works with us. We have a music therapist who also does some music therapy with the children. And then myself, and we really use all of our therapies to help make the hospital experience not as stressful and overwhelming, trying to give the patient some breaks in their schedule because it's so unknown. Another big thing that we do is we have a special treatment room, and I really do advocate for that as best as we can. In a hospital, your room is also the treatment room, and it's also everything. Everyone's coming into your room unannounced, doctors, nurses, anyone's coming in, and then they're doing procedures in there. They're taking blood or whatever they're doing. And so you don't really necessarily have that safe space in a hospital. And that is something that as a Child Life Specialist, we really advocate for, is a safe space. And that's really what the playroom is. There's no medical professionals allowed to come into the playroom because child needs to know that they're safe and that they're okay. And in the treatment room is where we try and do as many treatments as possible so that we can leave the room to be a safe place as well. And that, again, if you can advocate for your child to say, like, too many people in my room is overstimulating, that would be awesome. I've seen many situations where we have a child with autism and the doctor comes in with all the residents and the students and everyone, and then the child has a tantrum and has a behavior and they don't know what happened. So really trying to educate other people will really help the best, especially in medical situations.
Yeah, and I love that you bring up that point because I've been a student myself and I've worked in a hospital myself. And, you know, I've been on that end of wanting to be the observer and of wanting to see what's happening. And I would say when I was in those shoes, I didn't have kids back then, I was like, whenever a patient said, like, oh, I would prefer not. I remember like feeling like a little sting there for a second. And then when the tables turned and now I'm the parent, I went to a therapy session with quite a behavioral child. And there was an observing therapist there, psychiatrist. So it was one psychiatrist and then it was an observing psychiatrist. And they asked me, would it be okay if she observes? And I thought for a minute and the young me wanted to say, yes, of course, no problem. You could come in. And then I was like thinking out the situation, like what's going to happen when she gets overly, you know, maybe says something that she's uncomfortable with. What's going to happen when she wants to talk about something and she doesn't want a third person in the room? And I remember that being like a moment in my head where I said, wow, I grew up. I said, no, I don't feel comfortable having anybody else in the room. And it was like a aha moment for me because I had been that observer and I had wanted to be watching, you know, in the medical field. We all want to watch. We want to get the best experience that we could. And that's really great as students and as professionals. But as moms, caregivers, definitely advocating and putting ourselves in the client, in our children's shoes and thinking, like, how's the situation going to play out? Like, sometimes, like, I feel like we have to put, like, the slow down button on. We're like, okay, give me a minute. Let me think this through. And, like, a lot of times, especially in a hospital setting, things are being thrown from right and left. And, like, there's beeping and there's noises, right? And, like, we have to really just put ourselves in that child's shoes. And what are they thinking? And it's okay to say no sometimes. And it's okay to say, let's slow down for the child. And I love how you're bringing that topic up of someone that works in the hospital and saying, like, yeah, let's make a plan that works for my child. Don't feel shy. Because if you don't speak up, no one's going to speak up. Okay, amazing. So now, tell me a little bit more about other hats you wear in the hospital. We had touched on bereavement last time, which I thought was a really different and interesting topic that I would love to hear a little bit about. When do you show up and for that? And what kind of role can you as a child life specialist fulfill?
Sure. So that's also a pretty unique part of our job that not everyone realizes child life specialists do. A lot of times child life specialists get the title iPad lady or distraction lady or somebody that brings toys, which are all amazing parts and really great parts of our job. But there are a lot of parts that are harder. And one of those areas is the grief and bereavement that we specialize in. Our role, again, is to try and reduce the trauma and enhance the positive experience. And how we do that is we definitely get called for children who are very medically fragile or ill. But oftentimes it's for adults who are medically fragile, ill, grandparents, parents who are struggling with whatever medical illness is, maybe a new diagnosis, or somebody in the ICU, in the adult ICU. I'll get called all the time. The children, the grandchildren want to come visit. They can't. So children and grandchildren technically can't come into the hospital unless they're accompanied by a child life specialist so that we can really gauge how that child is coping and understanding and what are they processing and how are they processing? Is it appropriate for them to come? Do they understand what they're seeing? And breaking down all those things and helping them process seeing their loved one like that. And I've had many different situations where I've brought children in or grandchildren of a patient to come see their loved one before they do pass. And I've had a parent, one of the parents, like one of the children of the patient, say to me, my child has autism. I really want to bring them, but I'm unsure what to do. I feel they need to say goodbye. And again, you know your child best, but I do appreciate when people want to talk it out and have that knowledge to realize that not every situation is appropriate to bring a child to. And especially with a child who is maybe more anxious or maybe on the spectrum, it really can be too overstimulating and might bring the wrong effect. And sometimes it depends on what the parent tells me and how that child behaves in a typical day. I might suggest that they don't bring the child to say goodbye and that I can do some memory making. And I do memory legacy building activities. And I can make you a heart box with a thumbprint or some sort of memory for that child to have. But maybe it doesn't make sense for that child to come because, again, the beeps, the look of the patient, and it's not only the patient they're seeing, they're walking past all these other patients in the ICU. So even for a typical child, it really is overwhelming. It's overstimulating. And I think as a parent, especially when dealing with bereavement and grief, it's hard to look at the big picture and say, is this best for my child to come and visit? Or is it best for maybe the child life specialist can talk to them or read a book? Or there are many amazing books about bereavement and death and dying and how to talk to children. And not necessarily is it best to bring a child to the hospital. So I think it's a hard acceptance for parents, especially ones where maybe the nieces, the cousins are all coming and your child with autism is not going to come. But realizing that that might be best for your child is really important, especially in those hard times.
Wow. Wow. It's a really great topic. And it's something that is part of life. And I appreciate you broaching it and giving ideas. Another idea that I'm thinking, and you might have mentioned in our past conversations, was like also possibly doing like a FaceTime or a Zoom to give the child like the ability to see and say the goodbye. And sometimes I do like the topic of what you just touched on, where sometimes parents have things in their head as far as what the needs are, and not necessarily is that like aligned with the child and their emotions. But sometimes as parents, we do need to do things for ourselves to make us feel like our child's doing the right thing, or we're teaching our child the right gestures, or whatever it is, how we justify things in our heads as far as what we feel is needed. But there are different ways also to make solutions that could meet maybe in between, or let the parent feel like their need was met, and the child not have to go into like a busy hospital. But I also love that you're available to discuss it, because also sometimes in those moments, we're not necessarily thinking straight. We're not thinking with exact clarity. So it's good to have that ability to have somebody to talk it through with who has already gone through this multiple times.
Yeah, and it is a very sensitive, sticky situation. And so we try our best to obviously respect the family's wishes. And if that's what they want, then go ahead. But we do also want to be considerate for the environment and the child's processing and how they process things, especially like nonverbal children. You never know necessarily how they're going to react to what they see. They might play it out, which is something that we do as a child life specialist, is we'll play with a child, and depending on how they play, we're able to really see what they're processing sometimes. But children with autism, it's sometimes harder. And if they're nonverbal, they're not necessarily going to sit and play out what they just saw. So that can be intense, and they're just going to soak it in. So again, just reminding yourself that it's okay if your child doesn't come or doesn't fit the exact way you thought it was going to be, and that every child needs something different. Even a typical child that's just more anxious might not come, because it just why make them go crazy, you know? It's just a it's a very sensitive area, but we're here to help if we can.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, before we move on to your private practice, is there any other thoughts that you had that you wanted to share with caregivers of children with neurodiverse needs in the hospital setting?
Sure. I think really the only last thing that I know we discussed was that coming prepared, and I'm sure we already discussed it, but come prepared as best as you can. Obviously, sometimes you never know if you're going to have to call the an ambulance, and then you get transferred to the hospital. But if you do come by ambulance, try and ask for what they have. You never know. Some hospitals have more resources than you think, and sometimes they don't necessarily advertise that they have child life or resource or music therapy or art therapy. But just ask. It can't hurt to ask, and come prepared as best as you can. So I do like to tell parents that to try and come up with a coping plan so that you can send it to all the doctors and have it in like an emergency go bag of my child copes best when given this, or talk to like that, where my child doesn't react when said, when this person comes in, or when it's spoken to that way, and really just breaking that down on paper, because sometimes even in the moment when you're adrenaline is rushing, you're not going to be able to say that. So having that paper in the grab bag, so to speak, is very helpful. Also coming prepared, meaning bring stuff that that child or individual likes. You never know how long these hospital visits or even a doctor's office. Sometimes the doctor got called to an emergency or is just backed up, and you're sitting in the room or the waiting room, and it could be hours. It's annoying as an adult, and it's so annoying for me. I hate when you like think you're going to be there for an hour and it's like almost 2 hours and you're still waiting to see the doctor. It's really hard.
It is
So
hard.
even more so for a child with autism or neurodiverse emotions and regulations and stuff like that, to have a bag prepared with their fidget toys or snacks or whatever it is that works for them, headphones, sometimes voice canceling headphones. And don't be afraid to ask. Like, I know in our hospital, we do have noise canceling headphones if somebody forgets, but it's not the same that you have at home, or we have an iPad, but it might not be the same. So if you can try and remember yours, it's the best, and bring extra stuff. But if not, don't be afraid to ask, because they might somebody might have something to be able to help you.
And I think you told me last time how you have a bucket of different sensory fidgets for the children, which I loved, you know, as an OT. I was like, oh, yay. They incorporated the sensory end into this.
Yes. We have also those tiles. You know the tiles that have the paint in them? That if you step on them, the paint moves.
Yes.
I just bought those as I came on. I was like, these are the best things. So we have them on the floors. And I definitely have a bin at my desk of toys that work for children with autism, and I don't want anybody to touch them because super important. I even told you, like, we have some teethers sometimes, like a chew toy. So sometimes that works for a child, and if you forget it, sometimes ask. Like, we have, but not every hospital will have, and we might not have at a certain point because we are donation-based or stuff like that. But it can't hurt to ask and try and come as prepared as you can as a parent to expect the unexpected.
Yeah. And I love the messaging also of speak up. You know, you never know what's there and there's no reason not to ask. I feel like sometimes we turn back into schoolgirls when we get there and, like, you know, there's all these doctors and people saying jargon that we might not understand. And you are the client, you're the advocate for your child. So it's really important to ask and learn what's available. And I love that you gave us these ideas because sometimes you don't even know what to ask for.
Right. So true.
Okay, amazing. Tell us a little bit about your inspiration to open your private practice. Tell us where you're located and a little bit about what you do.
So I was inspired to open my private practice because I had gotten reached out to earlier in this year. Somebody reached out to me and said, can you work with my child? They're having a really hard time going to the dentist and I can't get them to go to the dentist. And I said, you know what? I actually probably can. And they said, do you have a private practice? And I said, no. And I learned how to do it. And I do have a private practice. It's called Heart of Gold.
I love the name.
Thank
it's
you.
It's in your email also. And I was like, Heart of Gold.
Yes.
That is great.
Yes. Heart of Gold, childlife@gmail.com. Or you can share my number later on.
Yeah, I'll put it in the comments below the podcast. So, yeah, go ahead.
And I see clients virtually in New York and in person in New Jersey. And I can help with all different things with medical preparations for doctors, dentists, blood work, playing, like through play therapy, through art, through coping plans and working through all different types of anxieties that a child might have. I can work with siblings on all different types of things as well. Sometimes siblings feel a little bit jealous. I feel like also with a child receiving all these ABA therapies and they're getting all the attention. And sometimes they don't understand that their sibling is different or something might be a little different. So I can work with that child and give them that individualized attention. And just working overall with the family, helping the parent understand. I can talk with parents. And overall, my goal is really just to support the family and the child through anything that might be stressful or medically complex in the medical world, more community-based. So what I love is that I can now do hospital-based and community-based.
Yeah, I love that because I get from my clients all the time, you hit one big one, dentist, and haircuts is another big one that I know a lot of people struggle with. So I could see where that could be really helpful to have that guidance.
Yeah, totally. I actually, funny you say haircuts, is that sometimes I've had mothers that come super prepared. Again, you can come prepared and ask. Sometimes people will come for like same day surgery not for a surgery, but for maybe an endoscopy or an EEG when they're under an MRI and then after they're putting on the leads on their head. And they're under sedation, the parent will be like, can I just shave their beard or can I cut their nails or like and come with like clippers and trimmers and they come and then they ask the anesthesiologist if they're comfortable with it. And I've seen many times that the anesthesiologist will say, it's okay, no problem. And
wow.
Their things are very hard for parents to accomplish. Very, very hard tasks, daily tasks to make your child look presentable and clean shaven and cut nails and these are super challenging tasks for parents to accomplish. So if you can ask and bring, and if the team is willing to, it can't hurt to ask. Feel free.
That's great, because I would never think to ask that.
I would never think. It's mom multitasking at its finest.
Yeah, that's really good. And you know what? These kind of ideas are really helpful, because when you're in the moment and you're there and you're like, hey, I heard that. That's a great idea. You could wrap your scissors and cut, like you said, come prepared. Bring the shaver along.
Right.
I love that. Okay, so tell us, you mentioned a little bit about sibling support, which I think is a great topic as well, because I feel like siblings, like you said, they almost get, you know, they get to watch their sibling, their neurodiverse sibling get all this attention and extra, and sometimes they do feel lost in the process. So what kind of things do you do for them, and how do you support them through that?
Sure. So it comes back a lot to what works for that child specifically. So it's not like a overall thing that I do for everyone, and meeting that child with something that might be fun for them. So it could be playing games, and through a game, they start to talk to me and tell me that this is really hard for them, or they feel that they don't get attention, or they feel different in school, or whatever they're feeling. And sometimes that just comes out just from them playing a game with me, a board game. Sometimes they don't want to talk, and sometimes just drawing helps. Sometimes just giving them that attention that they need is really what can help them often. And it's really hard for them, and I do really feel for siblings. I do focus a lot when siblings are in the hospital. I work with the sibling. I try and help or send something home or work with the parent to guide them on how to work with the sibling at home. But especially with children with autism, and this can be a daily thing, that the child is receiving ABA therapy or therapies or all this special attention, and the sibling goes to school and comes back and nobody's there for them. And that can be really hard and challenging as a child growing up of what's different with me? Why don't I get that service? So really having somebody else be there to help them process can really help, or play with them, or give them that support emotionally.
Yeah. And have the conversations and be open. I know, as a mom of six, I'm very divided. I can't say I'm not. And I always, like, at night I do a checklist in my head. Like, did I give each one of my children like that half hour of attention that I hope that they got? And I was just telling this to one of my friends, and she said, a half hour of attention per child? That's too much. Like, how do you even get that in? And I was saying, like, it doesn't really have to be sitting down and playing a game. Yeah, we could sit down and play a game. We could sit down and read a book. And those things, of course, happen. But like catching them when they walk in for 10 minutes and saying, here's your milk and cookies, let's sit and discuss your day, or let's discuss a topic that's interesting to you or anything that was on your mind. Like if I'm dressing one of my children in the morning or undressing them or bathing them at night, and instead of running off to play on my phone or answer texts or do Instagram or any of those things, sitting with them while they're taking that bath and like playing with the rubber ducky or playing with the make-believe toys that you threw in the bath instead of like, okay, now I'm off duty, really being on duty. And yes, we're definitely split. I always say sometimes I feel like a pizza pie, and that's just what it is. But I do think that we could almost focus on our neurotypical children, siblings, as well as neurodiverse children, while doing the regular things that we do.
Yeah. I originally, like I was saying in the beginning of this podcast, that I had a lot of experience working with typical and diverse children. I used to be a ABA therapist, and I would do that for a little bit. I was a para. And I would always say to the parents, like, when the ABA company or the ABA therapist is there, if the child is behaving, like, focus on your typical child. And focus on the siblings. Like, that's a great time for them to do homework or get them a treat or bake or do something fun with them, because you have somebody else that's there helping your child with autism. So as hard as that could be, because it might be a break, and I'm sure you don't have a break as a parent. I mean, I don't have a break. I feel like this is my break.
Right, we go to work to get a break. That tells us something, right?
Exactly, that's our break. It can be really beneficial to use that time even once a week to try and focus on your other children and give them a little bit of special time when you're able to.
Love that. I love that. Now, you also have been talking a lot about play, which I'm definitely very passionate about. I think that you could learn so much from play. Give us some ideas about what you've seen worked, what methods you've seen worked in play, because it seems like you're using that as a modality to get children to speak, to talk, to give you their emotions.
I use a lot of different types of forms of play. If it's a younger child, we'll use more imaginative play, playing with maybe a dollhouse or puppets or little figures trying to act out a situation. And maybe for more of a middle school or teenager, maybe some regular board game where it's turn-taking and waiting our turn and in between the turns talking a little bit. There's all different types of games. Sometimes it's not even necessarily a game, but it's just playing with kinetic sand. I love kinetic sand, where it's one of my favorite toys because it doesn't get dirty. and it's super soothing. So even just playing with kinetic sand and seeing what comes out and seeing how they interpret that, how they relax. Sometimes we do incorporate a lot of meditation and like calming breaths and coping skills in that way. And that really helps a lot of teens, and realizing like grounding yourself and realizing where you are and your space and where your head is. And sometimes so many thoughts flying through our heads. I find that at the end of the day, my head is spinning. There's so much going on that I'm like, the day's over. I didn't finish this. And then trying to like focus in and trying to ground it and realize what all the things we have done and where we are and what we could be grateful for, or stuff like that. So we do a lot of play. We do a lot of different types of coping skills. And play looks different for every age. And what play is interpreted differently.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Exactly. We're going to have nonverbal play, we'll have verbal play. And I do find that one of the big things that I learned when I went for my floor time course was that when we get on the level of the child, it sounds silly, but it really works. Not to be above the child, because it gives them a nonverbal interpretation of what we're up to. If we get down on that child's level and just make that eye contact, not forced eye contact, if they don't want to look at you, that's okay. But just to be eye level and almost say to them nonverbally by getting on their level, like, I'm in it with you. Yeah. We're together.
Yeah, totally. And that's why I think sometimes also like coloring, like you color with them, you play with them. It's not, here's a piece of paper and draw what you're feeling. And I could draw how I'm feeling and you also draw how you're feeling. But I do agree a lot about getting on that level. It is sometimes harder in the hospital to squat on the floor, but I'm building it up, building up resistance.
You're building it. And I always like sitting Indian style. My husband always laughs at me because even when I'm not on the floor playing with the kids, I'm Indian style. And he's like, you're going to be the most flexible old lady ever. And I'm like, yep, I am, because squatting's not my thing either. But I'll get like the child chair and I'll sit on the child chair with them, or I'll go Indian style.
I have to walk around the hospital with one next time. But yeah, so in general, during a play session, I do try very hard to get as close down to the child level so you're not over the child, which is really important.
That's
sitting
great.
on a bed or a chair next to each other is nice.
yeah, exactly. And sometimes with my own child, like, I'll lay on the bed with them while I'm reading the book. Exactly. Like, just like be equals, understanding, yes, as parents, we are the authority and we're above them and all of that. But if you want to get a child to communicate, then you got to get on their level, because they're going to share better that way.
Totally.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about your virtual therapy. How does that work? Do you feel like it works as well as in person? And where could people contact you for that?
Sure. So virtual and in person is the same contact, which I'll give you as the phone number, the email address. We're working on a website and other platforms, but we haven't had that yet because we're so new and just requested by parents. But we're getting there. I'm trying to balance it all between work and side hustle. But I just, my heart is there. I really am so passionate about helping children in the community and in the hospital, just trying to find those resources to help people understand the medical world, and all different types of support Child Life can provide. So I will get all that settled in at some point. But virtual therapy is obviously, in person is always going to be better. But virtual can provide a lot of therapy as well. And you can gain a lot from virtual. You can play virtual games, you can talk, you can watch some videos together. And there's a lot of different things you can do virtual. Again, it's not the same as in person. And I wish I could be in New York and New Jersey, but unfortunately not at this time. But there's a lot you can gain, which is, it's nice to have that platform post COVID.
Yeah. I actually did a little bit of Zoom over COVID, and I, as an occupational therapist, did not love it. I felt like I could do the coaching of, like, for the parents, but to get my hands to do the brushing and the lotion, I'm in such, in a profession that really needs its hands. But what it did open to us and the world is that, like, you could get a lot of coaching, a lot of good information off of virtual sessions, especially if you're dealing with, like, something niche that you really need to, you know, get somebody who understands it on a deeper level, and you don't have anyone in your area. It's worthwhile to be able to do that virtually.
Yeah, totally. And I can do a lot of those parent sessions, and those conversations can, a lot of them can be virtual and don't have to be in person, which also allows for the parent to be driving or accomplishing all the other stuff that parents have to do. So it does give a lot of flexibility with allowing that virtual.
That, and also because transitions are so difficult for children on the spectrum, sometimes parents will request for it to be virtual because it's easier than having to dress the child and get the child out. And if it's more of a consultative or a discussion or creating goals, and you can have the child playing in the background doing their thing, and then you're doing that discussion, a lot of times that is a more comfortable place to be.
Yeah, totally. And with that, I just want to add that I do come to you. So nobody has to come to me. I come to you in your house, or I can meet you at medical appointments. I can accompany you with you to medical appointments, whether it's a doctor's office or dentist or blood work or whatever it is, I can accompany with. Some parents feel that is helpful. Some parents feel that just talking it through, having their coping plan and their bag and whatever else they need is enough. And again, you know your child best. So advocate as best as you can. And if you need the help, hopefully you can find the support that you do need.
Amazing. Zahava, thank you for joining us today on the Autism Roundtable. If you had to leave off with one message for our parents, our caregivers, what would that message be?
So first off, give yourself a lot of credit. You guys work so hard, and I really do see the hard work that these parents are putting in. It's really, really hard. So kudos to you guys who are putting in that work and working with children with autism or on the spectrum. It's very hard, and I see it. And also, I guess, just as best as you can come prepared, be prepared, know the resources that you have, and the resources that are available to you. And it takes a community to, it takes a village to raise a child, and we're here. So I'm here if I can help. I would love to help you, whether in the hospital setting or community setting, but come as prepared as you can and advocate as best as you can. Don't be afraid to ask. It's really, we're here. Hopefully everyone's here to help you. And that's our goal.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us what a child life specialist does, and teaching us that we can request. And you know, I hope not to need it in the future, but I'm sure we all are going to come across that in our life as, you know, as life goes. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.